Welcome back to another episode of Good Friends and Great Adventures. I'm your host today, Max von Nünch. And yes, you heard it right. Today is actually the first English episode because we have a very special international guest here. In today's episode, we sit down with Peter Hammerstedt, Director of Campaigns at Sea Shepherd Global, who has been a good friend of the tour for several years. From his early days battling illegal fishing operations to how the birth of his son transformed his approach to risk, Peter shares personal and powerful insights from his journey as a leading ocean conservationist. We also dive into why ocean conservation is a crucial issue, not just globally, but right here in the heart of Europe too, touching on the challenges facing the Atlantic coast and the Mediterranean Sea. Get ready for a compelling conversation on protecting our planet's blue heart. And in case you don't already know, the International Ocean Film Tour is that film event for everyone who loves the ocean. Unique documentaries on the big screen, stories of people who inspire, but also remind us that we must protect the world in which we live in. You can find all the information in the show notes. Let's dive right in. All right. Welcome, Peter. Nice to have you here on the podcast today.
It's very good to be here. I'm really happy to join.
Would you like to start off and tell us where you are at the moment?
I am in Los Angeles in Southern California, the City of Angels. This is where I've been living for the past 5-6 years. And I spend more than half the year away from home, though, either on ships, on our many campaigns around the world, or meeting with our government partners who we're working closely with to stop illegal fishing. But Los Angeles, this is my home.
All right. So on the other side of the world, so it's probably bright and early?
It's bright, it's early, it's incredibly hot. We've had this heat wave hitting us over the past couple of weeks. I grew up in Stockholm, Sweden. I was living up in Sweden up until I moved here to Los Angeles. So it's a bit of a climate change being over here.
I can imagine from Stockholm in the summer, sometimes being kind of cold, then off to Los Angeles is quite a drastic change, I can imagine. Would you also be so kind and introduce yourself again?
My name is Peter Hammerstedt. I'm the Director of Campaigns for Sea Shepherd Global. I sometimes have the incredible privilege to captain our ships. I've been with Sea Shepherd since I was 18 years old, since I was old enough to submit an application to join as crew. I started as an oiler or an assistant engineer in the engine room of one of our ships and worked up my way up to captaining our ships. And I've been working with Sea Shepherd my entire adult life and more than half my natural life. It's the only job I've had other than being a barista when I was 16 or 17.
Okay, well, let us get back to the start. You said you started when you were 18 and you grew up in Stockholm. What did get you started in the first place? And have you had a special connection to the ocean from a very young age on?
We moved around a lot when I was a kid. So I grew up in cities from Kuwait City to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia to Beijing in China to London to just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. We were always on the move when I was young. And so my first real connection with the ocean came from seeing a photograph of a dead whale being pulled up the slipway of an 8,000-ton factory whaling ship down in the Antarctic. And seeing that image at the age of 14, it just shocked me to my core. I just could not believe that whales were still being killed in the late 1990s. And I knew that I wanted to do something to stop it. I joined Greenpeace when I was 17 years old, and around the same time, Iceland, my neighboring Nordic country, had made the decision that they wanted to resume their whaling activity after a 14-year hiatus. And in order to do it, they needed to rejoin the International Whaling Commission, this intergovernmental body that regulates whaling worldwide. And so there was a vote at this intergovernmental organization about Iceland rejoining. And Iceland rejoined at 19 votes to 18. And it was my country of Sweden that cast the deciding vote that gave them readmittance. And after the votes were tallied, the Swedish delegation realized that they'd actually pressed the wrong button during voting time. They'd actually voted incorrectly. And when they asked for a revote to be taken, that wasn't allowed under the bureaucracy of the International Whaling Commission. And I remember being 18 years old and learning that now hundreds of whales were condemned to die because this bureaucracy couldn't take 5 minutes to vote again. And I felt a tremendous personal responsibility because it was my country that had cast that deciding vote to allow them in. And at the time, Sea Shepherd had made the announcement that they were preparing a ship to go to Iceland to directly intervene in the killing of whales. And I felt there was nowhere else that I'd rather be. I felt a personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I felt that the approach of directly intervening and getting in the way was something that I wanted to do.
I totally get that. I just find it so fascinating when you say you just saw the picture and that this single picture pretty much paved the whole way for your career. And before we got in this conversation, I was thinking about the fact, like, for me, I moved to the southwest of France, so the ocean was usually a place where I went on vacation to, but I had no real relationship to the ocean. So I was wondering if you have had some deeper connection before that, like growing up on the coast and just seeing how it changes. But for me here, when I moved here, I had this idyllic kind of holiday vibe, and I went here because I'm a surfer. I love surfing. I love spending my time in the ocean. And on the first year, I was quite shocked that I found in the early month of the year between January and March, quite some dolphins on the coast. And that was for me like the first time I started looking into it, because I felt like, I thought it would be pretty safe environment for dolphins and even larger animals, because last year then we had a huge humpback whale washed up just on our home beach. And it was actually, for me, the first time seeing a whale. And I was so shocked that I didn't know what was going on. And then when I started looking into it, I found the operation you are running with Operation Dolphin Bycatch here in the Bay of Biscaya. Can you maybe give us a little bit of a background information what this operation is about?
Sure. So the first whale you saw was a dead whale on a beach. It wasn't a whale in the wild.
If a dolphin counts as a whale, which I think it is, I saw some dolphins while diving. But the first one I saw was on the beach, and I was shocked. It was a weird feeling, and it made me feel something I didn't know how to put into words, because it was just weird finding that place where I thought it was something where people go and have just fun and leisure and a good time. Yeah, I don't know. I just woke up in that moment to this topic.
Well, I'll start by saying, you know, unlike you, you're a surfer. I didn't grow up sailing or diving or surfing or spending time on the beach. It was seeing this image, right? In some ways, I think, okay, I didn't choose the cause. The cause chose me. Had it been an image of a dead rhino or a dead elephant, I may have been on a very different path in my life. But I always felt this connection to animals. And there was just something so extreme about the idea of unnecessarily killing one of the world's largest creatures so cruelly, that just hit it home for me, that really put me on the path I'm on. And you would think that a place like the Mediterranean, like the Bay of Biscay, that you would see dolphins all the time, because people aren't deliberately hunting dolphins there. There are only a few places in the world where people are deliberately targeting whales or targeting dolphins for their meat. There aren't that many places remaining where that happens. Mm-hmm. But whale populations, dolphin populations, they are at risk because of industrialized fishing. And that's why you're seeing fewer dolphins in the Mediterranean. It is because dolphins are getting entangled in fishing gear. And I joined Sea Shepherd because of the issue of whaling. And I came to realize through my time with Sea Shepherd that whaling was not the biggest issue facing whales and dolphins. Whaling was symptomatic of a more problematic relationship that we have with whales and with the oceans. Although Japan, Iceland, and Norway together kill about 3,000 whales every single year, over 300,000 whales and dolphins are killed annually through entanglement in fishing gear. And that means that industrial fishing is killing 100 times more whales and dolphins than whalers. What's happening in the Bay of Biscay is that dolphins are being caught in trawler nets, and it's killing tens of thousands of dolphins every single year. So we ran a campaign to expose that, to put pressure on the French government to create closure areas, areas that were set aside where trawlers could not enter during certain times of year when dolphins were at the greatest risk. And we've had tremendous success with that. And it shows, just like with that campaign to stop dolphin bycatch, as with the campaign against whaling in the Southern Ocean and the impact that that campaign had on me, that an image is a really powerful thing, that one image really can change the world. And I think that's one of the great strengths that Sea Shepherd has, is that through getting out to these far remote places, places that are only accessible by ship, we're able to bring these images to millions of people around the world, and we're able to then change policy. We're able to get people to reflect and change their relationship to the ocean.
100%. And I felt kind of bad when I moved here, because earlier on, like, I feel like many people in my, let's call it, bubble, go to the coast and they'd be like, yeah, I have a better conscience. I can start eating fish over there because it comes directly from there. So the impact is not as high. And then after I dove in, it's a personal decision, and I'm just talking to myself. I stopped immediately. I was like, okay, this can't be true. I was shocked that I didn't know. And I started running around asking my friends and everybody who came and visited. I was like, you sure you want to go to the markets? And I started to fill them in. And then I realized so many friends and people I met along the way, they kind of always think that whaling, and in terms of whales, dolphins, etc., just happens outside. I mean, Europe, obviously, Iceland and the Faroe Islands. I think so many people have heard of the Grand. But here, right on the coast, which is like France is, I think, the top two country for Germans to go on vacation to. Either it's the Atlantic coast or the Mediterranean. And I feel like not too many people were aware of that. And I think it is the point of view that what you're saying is that images, in that case, or videos, can transform a people's life and even the lives of the animals.
Well, I think if you're American or Swedish, as I am, or if you're German, it's very easy to condemn practices like whaling. Whaling is illegal in our respective countries. You can't find whale meat in a restaurant down the road. It's also illegal to buy shark fin soup in most of the places where we live, right? So it's very easy to look at shark finning and condemn it, because condemning it requires absolutely zero personal lifestyle change. Like, it doesn't really affect your life. But the same people who find the killing of whales, dolphins, sharks, sea turtles abhorrent would be absolutely shocked to realize that the fish that they're consuming is leading to the deaths of those creatures, right? So if we talk about sea turtles, there are seven major species of sea turtles. The vast majority of them, six out of the seven species, are either endangered or threatened. But there isn't a single fishery in the world, a single industrial fishery in the world, that targets sea turtles. And yet six out of the seven species are endangered or threatened. That's because they're getting caught up in fishing gear. So we have to seriously look at industrial fishing as the greatest threat facing the world's oceans, facing biodiversity in the oceans, facing ocean ecosystems. And that's true in the developing world. It's also true, it's very true of the Mediterranean, which is the most overfished body of water in the world, with the amount of large fish, predatory fish in the Mediterranean, down by 90% to what was there 50 years ago. And we adapt to diminishment, right? So we can't imagine how bountiful the oceans in the Mediterranean were 100 years ago, because we've already adapted to the oceans in this diminished state. And that's what makes talking about sustainability such a difficult concept to discuss, because we're already looking at the oceans from an, we're already talking about sustainability from the perspective of an almost emptied ocean.
Yeah, I mean, the word sustainability is used in so many terms and situations where I feel like nothing we really do is sustainable anymore, because as you said, we are way past that point. And you just said something which is kind of interesting. You said the ocean, how it looked before, like 15, 20, 30, I won't imagine 100 years ago. And for me, 2 years ago, I became a dad. You told me up front you became a dad too. So congratulations again.
Thank you. Likewise.
On that one. Thank you. And that also had some impact on my life, because I think most of the people listening who have kids maybe know the situation where you then start about, you start thinking about other things, like how will the future for your kid look like, etc. And until now, you faced some super high risk and situations you've been in where I say, okay, that's kind of tough. And I was wondering, from like a dad point of view, has your willingness to take risk kind of changed with that, or is it even stronger than before because you'd be like, okay, now I have to do it even more?
Well, I have a 3-month-old now, and he's just the absolute joy of my life. And having him is the best decision that I ever made. And it definitely does make the work that I do even more personal, right? Because I'm not just fighting for the timeline's been extended, right? You're thinking even more about future generations than you did, because as with your experience in the southwest of France, when the conservation issue becomes personal, you become even more driven. So the risks that I've taken, the risks that we take, have always been calculated risks. They're not unnecessary risks. And you have to weigh that against the risk of inaction as well. Like, what happens to the oceans if you don't act? So I'm still very, very comfortable doing the work that I do. And I'm really looking forward to the little man as he grows up, to being a part of that as well, and seeing that work and experiencing it for himself, and also then understanding maybe why his father had to go away from time to time when he was little.
I'm pretty sure he's gonna understand, but I feel like there's so many things that are changing in your life, from like sleepless nights, maybe dirty diapers here and then, but then obviously the point of that everything now about the future, whether it's environmental issues, wars that are going on, it just feels, I don't know, maybe it's not, obviously I can just talk for myself, but for me it feels way more personal, that I'm like, no, we definitely got to do something now, and we definitely even more got to step up. But again, I'm not in the situation where I'm on the forefront or on the front on a ship and fighting against huge trawlers. I'm only here in the roof of my house recording that that podcast to get the message out there.
Well, life on a ship prepares you for a newborn. When you're working on a ship and you're working in shifts and you're doing 4 hours on, 8 hours off, you're waking up throughout the night to go to the bridge, like you're prepared for it. It's just that what's waking me now is a crying infant, not the sound of the diesel engine, the cadence changing, right? So sleep deprivation is something that I'm used to.
That's good. I guess the motto of it is kind of like, expect the unexpected.
That's right. But what you're saying about the Mediterranean is super interesting, right? Because we're talking timelines, and we're talking, okay, my son and the future of the world's oceans, and that the timeline now being extended for me because I'm fighting for his future as well. If we pull that timeline back the other direction and go into our past, I mentioned that 100 years ago, 50 years ago, there was 10 times as many fish in the Mediterranean. If we go back even further to the time of the Roman Empire, there was a Greco-Roman poet named Oppian, and he was alive and he was writing during the rule of the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius. And Oppian wrote a four-part how to fish manual. It was like a fishing guidebook for the Mediterranean, in which he described different fishing techniques that could be effective for the Romans. And one technique was going out into a boat and taking a log or a big bit of wood that was covered in spikes. And you would throw this spiked log over the side of the boat. And as it would sink to the seabed, it would impale, it would spike fish on the way down to the bottom. And then you'd pull the spiked log up and it would just be covered in fish. And we read an account like this and we can't imagine that it's true, right? We think it's apocryphal. It must be exaggeration, because how could there be that many fish in the Mediterranean that you could just throw a log over the side and it would come up with fish? But there are so many accounts like this. There are accounts of seafarers crossing the Atlantic to fish off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland up in eastern Canada. And many ship captains from the Basque Country, from the Netherlands, from England wrote reports about there being so many fish, so much cod, that they could almost walk across their backs from ship to shore. And we think these are exaggerations because we can't imagine that the oceans were that full. But there's so many of these accounts that they were likely to be true. And that's what's incredibly alarming. The idea that, as you said, you expected to see more dolphins off the coast of France when you moved there. It used to be that ships would have to stop for 24 hours at a time in order to allow for pods of whales to cross their bow. There were whale traffic jams at sea, worse than Los Angeles traffic. And yet this seems like fantasy to us, because the reality really is so dark as to how bad things have gotten. And so we need to change a new reality, right? We need to change a new reality of what's normal for the oceans. And that means allowing the oceans to recover. It means allowing the oceans to rewild and get back to their natural state.
I think it's super interesting, as you said, the thing with the big pods and the super pods that the boats had to stop. I feel like everybody got their own reality within its limits, like obviously in relation to where they grow up, where they spend the most of the time. And when I went to visit my uncle, he's a diving instructor off the coast in Exmouth in Northwest Australia, at the Ningaloo Reef.
Yeah. Beautiful whale shark capital of the world.
Yes, he's working with some of these organizations and capturing all the moments. And I did my diving license with him. And for me, growing up in Europe, never been really overseas before, I haven't seen that many fish in my life. And he was like, yeah, but look at the surroundings. There's almost nobody around here. It's Exmouth. The next biggest city is Perth. It's roughly 1,500 kilometers south of it. And imagine how the whole world, that's what he said, like, imagine how the whole world would look like if there would be just less people on those coastal areas. And I feel like what he experienced was his kind of normal, even though he knew it's not the reality all over the world, but it's just so different to all the places where you just go.
You're 100% right. I've spent a lot of time in Gabon in Central Africa. Also, a lot of whale sharks there, in Ningaloo. It's a whale breeding ground. I've seen. Off the coast of Gabon, I've seen humpback whale acrobatics to rival what people pay to see off of Iceland, Norway, and Australia. But Gabon has a very long, very wild coastline with very little human habitation. There's the capital of Libreville, and then there's hundreds of miles of coast south of that where there aren't any people at all. A lot of those areas are marine parks and national parks. And it's the only place in the world where you'll see elephants, you'll see hippos, you'll see gorillas all intermingling all together on the same stretch of beach. Gabon has a phenomenon, which you'll like this being a surfer. They have a phenomenon of surfing hippos. So the hippos come from the rainforest. They go out through the lagoon, and they've discovered that the best way to transport their heavy bodies up and down the coast is to swim out to sea and allow the ocean currents to just take them up the coast. And when they get to a new area that they want to go ashore to, they just turn their bodies 90 degrees and they body surf back to shore. So there are still these incredible places, but they're exceedingly rare. And they're even more incredible to us now because of how rare they are. In the Mediterranean, I had a dear friend, and he was a longtime supporter of Sea Shepherd, named Enzo Mallorca, and he was a free diving champion of the world for over a decade. And Enzo told me, we were standing on the shore in Sicily in the remains of an old bluefin tuna factory. And he told me that when he was a young man, when he was a teenager, his job was to be the Judas tuna. And what that meant is the Sicilian fishermen would watch for the bluefin tuna migration to come past the shores of Sicily. And the Sicilians always referred to the bluefin tuna as half human, because they had one eye to the sea and they had one eye to land, because they'd hug the coastline so closely. And when they saw the bluefin tuna come, it was like a raging river. You could see it almost like you can see breaching whales offshore. You just see almost like the ocean was boiling, because that's how many fish were there. And when they'd see the bluefin tuna coming, when they'd see this raging river of fish, they would get into their boats, and they had a series of cages that were set up offshore, and they needed to lead the fish into these cages. And that was Enzo's job. So they would drop Enzo off in his boat right in front of the fish, and he would then lead them into this series of cages. And then last minute, he would escape through a little hatch in the top, and all the fish would be caught, and then the fishermen would just slaughter them in mass.
Was he underwater? Was he diving and leading the
ocean? He was free diving. So he would spend, you know, 3-4 minutes underwater, swimming through this network of cages, leading them through. That's why they called him the Judas tuna, and then escaping through a hatch. Finally. And it was interesting to hear him describe, you know, this raging river of bluefin tuna, because it's not something that we can imagine in Southwest France or Southern Italy today. The idea that you're standing on the beach and you're watching this migration of fish, you're like, the bluefin tuna are coming. But that's because bluefin tuna numbers are also down by 90%, right? But this is within a generation. This is not, we're not talking the Greco-Roman poet Oppian. We're talking, this is the 1900s this was happening. And today you certainly can't stand on a beach in Sicily and see a fish migration pass.
Yeah, and I can't imagine how it must felt for him being suddenly part of this school, because you're not diving, you're not breathing, so you feel probably more like a fish than a human when you're just more or less within the youth school.
But, yeah, absolutely, and then he felt a tremendous guilt from being part of that fishery, and he decided to dedicate his entire life to conservation. He told me he was off Syracuse in Sicily, and he was spearfishing, and he speared one fish, a dusky grouper, and this fish wasn't killed and hid behind some rocks on a cliff face, an underwater cliff face. And as Enzo went to reach in to grab this fish and pull it out, his hand touched her side, and he could then feel her heart racing and beating. And that was when he decided he was done with spearfishing.
I feel like, and it just came to my mind, that so many people, obviously in a percentage, it's not too many, but so many stories I hear from people who are in conservation have been on the other side before. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's maybe part of the reason, because so many people just don't know what's going on underneath the surface, and that, yeah, the people who are wanting to change something and who are up on the forefront, yeah, they might have been doing the exact opposite for years before, just like your friend, since they came to the realization that it's maybe not the right thing to do. But I wonder, after all these years, you said you spent so many years of your life doing it, can you go to the beach and enjoy a beach day, just being on the beach? Is it something you do, or is there just so many things going on that you might be or could be doing at the same time?
There's no lack of beaches here in Southern California, right? So, but there's also no lack of mountains. And I guess I've always felt that I spend enough time at sea and on the sea that when I'm away from it, I'd rather go to the mountains. But yeah, for sure, I get to enjoy living here close to the Pacific, and absolutely I get to enjoy it. But when you're spending, or when you have, as I did, you spent 8, 9, 10 months at sea. When you get back to land, sometimes you want to hug a tree.
I can imagine that. Yeah. Maybe you're right. I was just wondering. Sometimes I have the feeling when I'm on the beach just sunbathing after a surf, you'd be like, there could be so many things to be done at the moment. That sometimes when it strikes me, I just start collecting trash or just do something on the beach to have a little impact.
Well, I remember when about 9 years ago now, we chased the most notorious poaching vessel in the world, an illegal fishing vessel called the Thunder, which was fishing illegally for Patagonian toothfish down in the Antarctic. And we chased this ship for 110 days until the captain of the vessel decided to sink his own ship to destroy the evidence on board, because he couldn't shake us. He couldn't lose us and end the pursuit. And we had to rescue him and all of his crew. But this became the longest maritime chase in history. We were with this boat for 110 days. And I remember day 90, day 100 into this chase, and looking out at the ocean and seeing 1,000 shades of blue and gray and a landscape that hadn't changed much in those 100 days. And thinking, okay, when this chase ends, whether it's tomorrow or whether it's in 2 years, then I'm gonna get to the forest. I need to spend time in the absolute opposite of this. And I remember being on the bridge and watching the Thunder off our bow, and having a big atlas in front of me and planning what my trip would be at the conclusion of this of this chase. And it wasn't enough that everything felt extreme. So it wasn't enough that I was gonna go see trees, it was going to have to be the biggest trees in the world, right? So I wasn't just going to go into the forest. I was going to go to Sequoia National Park in California to be with the biggest trees, just to be the absolute opposite of where I found myself.
In between those moments, obviously, I think most of the listeners have heard of that chase. Do you sometimes have those days where all the moments together just become a big blur and you just sit there and be like, what am I doing here? Or is it, do you never have these moments when you're out on a mission?
I'm results driven, and our campaigns have tremendous results. And there was a time while we were pursuing this ship that we were drifting. The Thunder had shut down their engine to conserve fuel. We did as well. And so we were only consuming the small amount of fuel that our generator was burning to keep the lights on. And so we had enough fuel that if the Thunder drifted indefinitely, we could have been with the ship for over 2 years. That's the kind of endurance that we had from a fuel perspective. And I remember asking my chief cook if we had enough food to stay out for 2 years. And I'll always remember what she told me. She said, "We have enough rice and we have enough beans to survive at sea for 2 years." The key word being survive. And our sister ship had just confiscated 72 kilometers of illegal fishing net that had been abandoned by the Thunder when we initially found them fishing down in the Antarctic. And they started to run and the pursuit began. And they were about to go back to Mauritius to hand this net over as evidence to the International Criminal Police Organization, Interpol. And so there was an opportunity with our two ships meeting for some of my crew to transfer over to the other vessel. And so I had a meeting with the crew and I told them, look, here's the reality. If the Thunder drifts indefinitely, we could be at sea for up to 2 years. There's no guarantee of outcome. It could be that after a year, we have some kind of mechanical breakdown, some kind of engine issue, and the Thunder gets away. Could be that after a year and a half, we finally go into port with them and our ship is arrested, not them. All we know with 100% certainty is that every day we're with this ship, they're unable to fish for Patagonian toothfish. It means that as soon as we were to leave them, they'd go right back to fishing. But every day that we're with them, they're not fishing and we're saving thousands of animals. And if you want to stay, you have the opportunity to transfer over to the other ship. I completely understand if you can't commit to 2 years of being on a ship. But if you stay, that's the only thing I can promise you, that every day that we're with them, we're saving toothfish. That has to be reason enough to stay because we don't know how it's going to end. And out of 30 crew, I had 26 people stay and four leave. 26 people who were committed to potentially being stuck on a boat for 2 years because that was enough for them. And that for me is incredibly inspiring and motivating. Like that kind of dedication, I think, is incredibly rare, but you do find it at Sea Shepherd. So quiet days at sea are often very good days because it means that we're having an impact where we are. We're either the fishing isn't able to happen because we're there, or we're protecting a marine park and our presence there means that the poachers aren't coming in. So quiet days are days to celebrate. When I spend a quiet day on the ship, I'm absolutely reminded of why we're there, because we're having that impact.
That's a good thing. And I can imagine after you look at the atlas for the biggest trees, you're probably on the hunt for a big plate of vegetables after rice and bean for weeks and months on. Let's dive a little bit into one of your latest campaigns or operations, Return to Antarctica. The movie has been part of the International Ocean Film Tour, Volume 10. And I wondered, you've done quite some campaigns, but what do you feel when you go back on a ship and leave the harbor for the first day on a new operation?
It's an incredible feeling, because when we're going off on a campaign, it comes with a lot of history, right? What you have in your baggage is the experience from campaigns in the past. So you know what we're capable of as an organization. So heading down to Antarctica to take on the krill fishery, you do that with the knowledge that chasing whaling ships down in the Southern Ocean for 15 years did result in the end of whaling in Antarctica. There are no whales being harpooned in Antarctica today because of those interventions and because of the government action that they inspired when Australia and New Zealand ultimately took the government of Japan to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. And they ruled that whaling in Antarctica was illegal. We shut down illegal fishing in the Southern Ocean through the chase of the Thunder, but then also because the chase of the Thunder inspired governments around the world to arrest the five sister ships of the Thunder. They were arrested in Senegal, in Cabo Verde, in Indonesia, and Malaysia. And so in 2 years, started with the chase of the Thunder, but within 2 years, there was no more illegal fishing down in the Southern Ocean. So we knew what we were capable of going after the krill fishery. We knew the kind of action that we could take that would inspire governments to finally stop this incredibly destructive but legal practice. And we needed to generate enough publicity, and we needed to bring these images back home to get what was legal made illegal.
Okay, and you just touched on it briefly. You said you went out there not to stop whaling, because that has been stopped before, but to stop fishing for krill. Could you fill us in what like the main subject of this operation is, and what does it actually mean or why are they hunting for krill in the first place? Would maybe be the first question.
The krill is a small little shrimp-like crustacean They're only a couple of centimeters in length, 2 to 6 centimeters. They are the foundational species for the entire Antarctic ecosystem. So there isn't a single species down in Antarctica that doesn't either directly depend on krill for survival or depends on a species that depends on krill for survival. For baleen whales like humpback whales and fin whales, krill is their primary source of food, their primary source of calories. The same is true for many species of penguin. The same is true for a lot of seals. And yet krill numbers are on the decline. They're on the decline because of climate change, and every single year is a new record year for low sea ice concentration in the Antarctic, and krill need sea ice in order to hide from predators, but also in order to feed on the phytoplanktons that form underneath the sea ice. And as krill populations are going down, we're seeing the impact on other creatures. So we're seeing humpback whale pregnancies on the decline. We're seeing the body mass of seals decreasing because they're not getting enough caloric intake. And we're seeing a krill fishery that's now an additional threat to krill numbers. And it's one that has the intention of expanding. So there are about 12 or 14 of these super trawlers operating down there today, each one of them with a fishing hold, a cargo hold that is as big as 2 Olympic-sized swimming pools. And they are taking the very food source of whales and seals and penguins. And they're doing it to create 3 products that are completely unnecessary. And that's at the heart of the insanity of all of this. So they're taking whale, penguin, and seal food in order to create omega-3 health food supplements for which there are plant-based alternatives. The reason why krill have omega-3 in their small bodies that are then ground up and boiled is because they eat algae, they eat phytoplanktons. And so we can cut out the middleman, we can cut out the middle krill and go straight to the same source. We can get our omega-3 from algae. The krill are being taken in order to create a feed additive for fish farms, for salmon farms. And so salmon flesh is naturally pink because they eat small crustaceans in the wild. But when you're raising 50,000 salmon in a pen in a beautiful Norwegian or Tasmanian fjord or bay, the salmon flesh is gray, and the nobody's going to buy gray salmon flesh at the market. And so they add krill to the feed of the fish at these farms in order to turn their flesh pink. And finally, there are new markets developing for creating krill-enhanced dog and cat food. And so these are 3 industries that are either, you know, there are alternatives or they're unnecessary or they're just for aesthetics, right? And that to me is absolutely insane that here are these 12 to 14 ships, each one of them over 100 meters in length, going down to the bottom of the world to take penguin, seal, and whale food in order to, so that we can feed the krill to our cats and dogs.
It's crazy. And I'm actually, I'm not really sure what to say about this. I'm always in shock. What I also find quite surprising is you said early on there have been a few sister ships of the Thunder who've been mainly responsible for the illegal fishing activities around these areas, and 5 isn't, I mean, it's 5 too much or 5 too many, but it seems like a number which is not too far away. Same within the Antarctica. I didn't know it was still 12 is still 12 too many, but it feels like something, and that's now where I start to realize it's something which is reachable, where you can go to and say, okay, it's 12, now I'm down to 11 and 10. I always personally thought this would be numbers into the hundreds,
right.
Like running around in a maze and collecting ship after ship. And whenever you get to one, there's another 2, just like a hydra, where you like cut off one head and there's 2 new ones coming out. But this actually sounds like the impact is real. So you're just down there. And I think in the end of the movie, you say something that the operation has continued. So what's the what's the current state of it at the moment?
I think it is an achievable goal, because nobody can make the argument that, oh, well, this fishing has to continue to combat food insecurity, right? Like the krill aren't being taken to feed hungry people. Like, that's not an argument that can be used. This is completely unnecessary. This is a luxury product. It's not anything that is anything other than that. I'll say the impact of one ship can be tremendous. Just to go back to the Thunder really quickly, they would go on 3 fishing expeditions a year. And on each fishing expedition, they would leave port with 600 kilometers of illegal gill net in their holds. This is like, these are invisible curtains of death that catch anything that swims into them, 600 kilometers. And because it was illegal net, you're not allowed to use gill nets down in Antarctica. They wouldn't want to return back to port with the gill nets on board, because this was evidence of their crime. So as they would approach the Malacca Strait and they would get ready to go to Singapore or to Thailand to offload the catch, they would dump all the nets overboard. They would get rid of the evidence at sea. So you imagine they would leave with 600 kilometers. They'd come back with zero. They would do this 3 times a year. We talk about cleaning up beaches, right? We talk about ocean plastic pollution. Here was one single ship dumping 1,800 kilometers of net at sea every single year. And not just any kind of plastic. This is plastic that's deliberately designed to entangle wildlife. And this is one ship. With the krill fishing boats, one of these vessels can take 500 tons of krill every single day. And that's about the amount that 50 humpback whales eat. And I started by saying these krill are about 2 to 6 centimeters in length. So you can imagine how many individual krill make up 500 tons. So the impact on one of these ships is tremendous. There are plans afoot to build another 2 of these vessels in Norway, there were plans to build another 3 in the Russian Federation, although I think the plans to do that are kind of on ice at the moment because of the war in the Ukraine. There are plans to build another 3 or 4 of these vessels in the People's Republic of China. So the time to act is now, right? If we don't act now, then the amount of krill super trawlers in 5 years could be twice as many as we're dealing with now. And it's easier to stop 12 than it is to stop 24, as you rightly pointed out. The battle now is over marine protected areas, and there are plans to create a marine protected area around the Antarctic Peninsula, which is where all the ecotourism ships go. It's also where the krill super trawlers go when the ecotourists are not there. And if we can lock up those areas to fishing, if we can set aside those areas as real wildlife sanctuaries, then that would be the beginning of the end of this krill fishery. So as we return to the Southern Ocean, it's about really building that movement to create these marine protected areas.
I always wonder, so if there's laws, if it's forbidden to go there, would it still be the case that nobody will go there? Or would you still be out there patrolling the waters just to make sure that nobody does it? Because these are places that are so far off, so remote, that I feel like there's quite a few things that are illegal. And I mean, there's quite a bit of illegal fishing activities. How can you ensure this actually will stop them from doing this?
Well, first of all, the Antarctic is one of the most surveilled areas of water in the world, because there are weather satellites there. There are countries with a political interest in Antarctica. You know, the Australian authorities fly over the continent regularly. It's a vast area, but thanks to satellite technology, it's pretty well covered. And that's why we know now that there's no illegal fishing happening to date, because there are no dark vessels that are operating, vessels that are not transmitting their location down in the Southern Ocean. So the first key is absolutely getting the laws changed, which in this case means creating these marine protected areas so that the legal krill fishery has to take a step back. Then there is the risk of an illegal fishery coming up, but we can then deal with that in the same way as we did with the Thunder case.
Okay. So then you just, if there's any activities, you just try and go after them.
Yeah, the tactics will always have to revolve around the specific problem. So when it was illegal whaling in the Southern Ocean, we could physically get in the way and block the harpoons. And because the whalers were the ones breaking the law, they were the criminal operators. With the case of the Thunder, we could chase them until, you know, the ship, the captain decided to sink his own boat because they were the lawbreakers. In the case of the krill fishery, it's crazy, but it's perfectly legal to take a 110-meter vessel dragging a net big enough to swallow a jumbo jet and drag it through a feeding frenzy of fin whales and humpback whales and take their food right from in front of their very mouths. At the moment, that's legal. I think for most people, it's that's crazy that that's legal. But we can get those laws changed, right? And once those laws are changed, once you have the legal framework, and then they break the law, then you can enforce against the law. But the law has to come first.
Okay. So you're always more or less trying to take actions on the front and like on the water and on land by regulating the laws at the same time.
You need to do both. Being on the water inspires that action to be taken on land, right? Because I can talk about these krill super trawlers all day and it doesn't have the impact as an image of that super trawler does, right? Seeing that super trawler moving through a pod of whales with humpback whales and fin whales breaching right in front of their bow. That's the kind of image that, just like for me, seeing that image of a whaling ship that is no more, seeing that ship at 14 and the impact that had on my life, seeing the image of one of those krill super trawlers today, 25 years, you know, after I saw that image of that whaling ship, somebody today seeing the image of that krill super trawler, the new threat to the Antarctic, that can have a massive impact.
Yeah, 100%. And the current state then is, are you still out there, or is somebody still out there taking down ships more or less, or no, not taking down ships, but taking imagery and showing it to the public, or is it on hold at the moment?
No, we just had another Antarctic expedition this last season. So since the images captured in the film that's part of the International Ocean Film Tour, we've been down again. We continued to make the case. There was a debate at CAMLR, which is this intergovernmental body that regulates the krill fishery, and there was a debate there to increase the krill fishing quota. The fishing industry wanted to double or triple that quota, but the quota remained unchanged. It didn't get increased. Okay. And we saw that as a tremendous victory. Yeah. Of course, we want to see the quota go the other direction, but it not being increased was a win. And coming up in this next CAMLR meeting in October, the Antarctic Peninsula Marine Protected Area will be up for discussion. So the battle continues on a daily basis. We'll continue going down to the Antarctic. We have a long time commitment to protect the Antarctic. And at the same time, our work continues in other parts of the world as well. We had a ship that was in Tuvalu in the South Pacific fighting illegal fishing there. We have two ships operating off the coast of West Africa fighting illegal fishing there. And through those campaigns, we've assisted our government partners to arrest 99 ships for illegal fishing to date. And for me, each one of those arrested vessels is an illegal floating slaughterhouse shut down.
Yeah, and I feel like what you just said, that from chasing the Thunder from the movie, which is, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, to now, I feel like Sea Shepherd maybe kind of changed from throwing themselves, or at least from my opinion, throwing themselves like in between in front of the trawlers, and more like working together with the government by providing ships and people and all this knowledge, and just go out there and work together
I think a critical transformation happened, which is that if we're serious about protecting the oceans, we have to deal with the biggest problem facing the world's oceans, and that's industrial fishing. It's not whaling. Yeah. It's industrial fishing. And when 90% of the world's fish, so we know already the the terrible statistics about overfishing. We know that the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization state that 90% of the world's fisheries are either fully exploited or overexploited. 90%. Mm. And we know that driving that is illegal fishing, with 20% of the global catch of fish caught through illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. So if we can deal with the illegal fishing side, where we already have the laws in place, we could theoretically eliminate 20% of global fishing pressures. That's just enforcing laws that are already on the books, right? And when 90% of the world's fish are caught in the waters of countries, because you don't just find fish just anywhere offshore. Most fish congregate around continental shelves and seamounts and reef systems. And if 20% of the global catch of fish is illegal and 90% of the world's fish is caught in the waters of countries, then you've got to work with countries to help them enforce the laws that are already in place. And that's the realization that I came to. And there are a lot of countries in the world that have a Coast Guard, they have a Navy, they have a maritime police, but they don't have the vessel that can actually take the police to the scene of the crime. And that's what we've been doing. We realize that we can't really bring about change within a vacuum. You need partners to do it. And that includes government. That includes the generous supporters and donors who help fund our missions. It includes partners like the International Ocean Film Tour that through its venues, through its events, are able to bring ocean issues into the public consciousness. It really requires all of us. We don't get to do it on our own anymore.
That's very well said. And I think we can almost come to an end with that. But before we leave you, or you leave us, I got three very quick questions for you, which I would love for you to answer, if possible, in one or two sentences. So, first one, was there a moment in your career where you actually thought of quitting?
No, that's the honest truth. There was no real, even in the chase of the Thunder, where 100 days and 50 days into just drifting with this ship and absolutely nothing happening and days being passed by playing cards and watching reruns of The Office on television. It was knowing that even on the quiet and slow days, we're having an impact and we're saving lives. And for me, saving lives, saving animals was the reason I got involved. And I believe that what we're doing is the most effective way to achieve that. So no, there was always a thoughts of how tactics would evolve and how we could become more effective, but never to quit.
True dedication. Second one, biggest win until today.
For me, the biggest win is setting up these government partnerships where we have partnerships with 8 countries around the African continent. We now have a partner country in the South Pacific, and that's just the beginning. We'll have more partners there as well. But shutting down illegal fishing boats, 99 of them to date. And just as an example, one of those ships was a ship called the Lobico 2. This was a boat operating off Liberia in West Africa. And it was licensed for tuna fishing using long lines, but when we boarded the ship together with the Liberian Coast Guard, we found not a single tuna on board and not a single long line. They were using gill nets to catch deep sea sharks for producing shark liver oil. And this one vessel was killing about 250,000 sharks every single 6 months. They're killing 500,000 sharks every single year. That ship was arrested about 6 years ago. It hasn't fished since then. That's over 3 million sharks saved to date. That's a tremendous victory. And that's one out of 99 ships that we've assisted our country partners to arrest. So that's what I'm most proud of. I mean, certainly the chase of the Thunder might be the most memorable. Yeah. But setting up these partnerships and seeing the result of them and working side by side with our government partners to really arrest ships and shut them down, that's what I'm most proud of.
Well, the 3 million lives really struck me. It's always something if you put those things into numbers where you realize and just add it up over months and years to come, what's actually on the line.
Although it's a bit of a double-edged sword, right? Because when you talk about numbers that high, it's very hard to motivate people and to get them involved, right? So it's crazy. Yeah. This one ship was killing 500,000 sharks every single year. And I could say that between 73 and 100 million sharks are killed every single year. But it's such a large number that it's an abstraction for most people. They can't even wrap it around their head. It was Joseph Stalin who said, you know, one person's death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic, right? And that's not that I'm quoting Joseph Stalin every day, but there are like millions and millions of deaths do become so you can't wrap your head around it. It's a number too big for people to quantify. And that's absolutely true of what's happening to the oceans. And so when I think about the 500,000 sharks that were killed every single year by the Libico 2, I think of it in terms of, okay, this was 500,000 times one individual shark, right? This was 500,000 individuals that were saved. And each one of these individuals had a right to life off this coast in Liberia, to be a deep sea shark, and that life was ended. But it wasn't now that the Libico 2 was shut down.
Maybe that's a good way to put it, just to see it as 1,000 individuals and not 1,000 as a whole number. Last but not least, where does Peter you stand in 10 years from now? Are you still on the ship, or are you maybe back on land changing the laws?
The ocean problems aren't going to go away in 10 years, unfortunately. And there are many things that are going to come up in the next 6 years that are really critical. One of those is there's a 30 by 30 commitment by the member states of the United Nations to set aside 30% of the world's oceans as marine protected area by 2030. To date, there's only 3% of the world's oceans covered, right? So there's a long way to go in 6 years to live up to that commitment. Once these areas are set aside, enforcement's going to be the greatest challenge. And especially when we're talking about high seas marine protected areas that are outside of any national jurisdiction. And so the problems are going to get even bigger. The solutions are going to have to get even more creative. I'm certainly going to be with Sea Shepherd, and I'll still be going out to sea. It won't be the 10 months a year that I was going out to sea in my young 20s, but I'll still be spending months of the year at sea, because I think you need to be on the front lines. You need to see it for yourself to be able to come up with effective solutions to it. And especially when you're communicating about these problems to a wider audience, they need to hear it not secondhand, from you secondhand. They need to hear it from you firsthand.
Thanks a lot for your honest answers today and for all the stories and knowledge that you shared with us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Max. Yeah, for me, it's got to be personal, right? And it's one of the ways, continuing to go at sea is one of the ways for me to combat that abstraction. You know, I have days where I get onto an illegal fishing boat, and that boat is arrested, and we're escorting it back to port. And I'm standing on the bridge of the ship, and I'm looking at this ship going into port. And I'm thinking, like, wow, this ship is not fishing today because we intervened. How incredible that is. And every day they're going to spend in port is like 20,000 animals saved. How amazing is that? What impact that a small group of people can have as that? But there are times when I'll get onto a legal fishing boat and it's being checked for compliance and it wasn't breaking the law. So the authorities have to let it go. And it's on those days that, you know, I'll get to a kind of secluded corner of the deck where nobody's watching, and I'll take two fish and I'll throw them over the side and watch them swim away. And I'll think, as I get back to my ship, I'll think, okay, well, this ship continues to fish because legally we couldn't do anything about it. But at least going out to that boat today, I saved two fish. And that's just my own little personal thing that I do to kind of keep sane. And I don't know if I could continue being sane unless I had those little moments. So that's one of the reasons I'll keep going out to sea.
At the end of the day, it's also always the little things, I guess, that gets you going and keeps you motivated. So thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you, Max.
All right, over and out. Thank you, everybody, for listening. That was Peter and me, and I gotta say that I'm super inspired that he never thought about quitting. And how amazing that being a dad has only sharpened his view for the work that still has to be done. And I find it also super impressive that he makes the mission to save thousands of individual lives a personal one by bringing back pictures that inspire all of us to help making the ocean a more protected place. I hope you guys are inspired as I am after this podcast. And if you like this episode, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Write us a comment and share this episode with a friend or maybe even two. This really helps us moving forward. So I'll see you soon, either on one of the next screenings of the International Ocean Film Tour or right in our happy place, the ocean. Until then, bye.